From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Inside GCHQ. In this exclusive episode, podcast producer Mark Cotton was given special permission to record inside the normally top secret walls of GCHQ in Cheltenham. There he met their official historian, Tony Comer, to talk about the life of a modern GCHQ insider, as well as the history contained in their own secret museum. Tony also gives us some sneak peeks into how their upcoming centenary in 2019 will be celebrated.
I'm sat somewhere now that if you were to ask me 10 years ago, I don't think I'd ever have thought that I would be sitting here. I'm sat in GCHQ. And it's been quite a strange journey because you realise you're coming to one of the most secret places in the world and go through a number of levels of security to get in here. And it's like another world in a way. I've got Tony Comer, the official GCHQ historian, with me. And we're going to talk about really the changes to GCHQ and how it's changed over the years and how it is for someone personally to actually work here and have had their career here. Now, Tony, you've not always been the historian. We're not going to talk about what you did, but you've worked for GCHQ for a number of years, haven't you?
I've worked here for 34 years, and I'm part of the generation that joined an organisation that nobody knew what it was, what it did. And I've gone through all of the change to GCHQ in 2017, where everybody knows about it, and lots of people think they know all about what we do. Some things have changed already. For example, you know, you say you're not going to ask me about what I did before I was historian, but I'm already in a position where I say that this is my first non-operational job. I joined as a linguist originally, as a Spanish and Portuguese linguist in 1983. I've since done a variety of other jobs, but most of the focus of what I've done in my career has been around supporting British and Allied military. And for 6 years, I was the UK representative on the NATO Signals Intelligence Committee.
This is the nub of it, really. I mean, even at the start of the podcast 6 years ago, we couldn't even say your name, could we? We could say the GCHQ historian. We couldn't take a photo of you. We couldn't record you. We could talk about what you'd spoken about. But the changes that you must have seen in those years must be astronomical.
You're right. We've gone from a GCHQ when I joined where the canteen menu was classified. Basically, if it didn't actually have the word unclassified stamped top and bottom on the document, you had to assume it was classified. In theory, it would be breaking the Official Secrets Act to go home and tell your wife that you'd had sausage and chips for your lunch or something like that. And perhaps it's interesting to reflect on the changes that have mainly happened in the time since I've become the historian at GCHQ. I think a lot of people say, oh, I know why you're doing all this now. It's because of Snowden. And that really isn't true at all.
Well, your role started before that even.
Well, I took on this post in 2009. Now, interestingly, that was the year of the centenary of MI5 and the Secret Intelligence Service. We're 10 years younger. And if you'd asked me in 2009, what our centenary would be like, I would have thought that we'd have said, well, it'll be like the other two, but maybe not quite as public because people aren't as interested in us. You know, you've got James Bond represents the Secret Intelligence Service. You've got Spooks, if you want to know about MI5. I think we found when we did the massive release of information between 1994 and 2004, that there's a phenomenal interest in Bletchley Park, but that perhaps is a bit of a caricature interest. perhaps there's quite a lot of mythology.
Yeah, definitely.
Alan Turing broke Enigma and then GCHQ went to Chelsea.
Yeah.
Sort of sums up, I think, quite a lot of people. But the sort of what happened before that, what had happened from 1914 to 1939? What was the organisation that actually got up and went to Bletchley Park? There's not any great interest in the public in that, in spite of things that we've tried to do, in spite of things that Bletchley have tried to do with the Road to Bletchley Park exhibition.
You've spoken at Bletchley Park about the work that was done between the two wars, because the early work of GCNCS was quite phenomenal, wasn't it?
Yeah, the most successful cryptanalytic organisation there ever has been in the world. But it's not something that lights people's lights up.
No.
And so I think if anybody had asked me 2009, how do you think you'll celebrate your centenary? My idea would have been to say, we'll probably do another big release of information, maybe about the Cold War, and it'll be available if anybody's interested enough to go and look at it.
Yeah, and it would have been quite a selective group of people who would have been interested, probably.
Indeed. Yeah. But we first started, I think, to come out of the shadows at the time of the Turing centenary.
Mm.
And our then director, Ian Lobban, did a major speech at Leeds University. And that was quite a deliberate thing. This was the first time you'd have a GCHQ director making a speech in public, and not just to a sort of select audience at one of the institutes like RUSI or anything like that. But here he was at Leeds University in a speech that was advertised in advance. And this was something very deliberate. This was a real attempt to put a toe in the water and find out what sort of reaction there would be to our doing this. It was interesting to see Professor Barry Cooper, and the reason we did it at Leeds was as a way of giving a tribute to Barry for all of the work he'd done in making the centenary year of Alan Turing such a success.
The amount of work he put into that, I mean, I was involved with the Turing centenary myself. I mean, that's how I got involved with Bletchley Park. But the years of work that Barry put in was remarkable, wasn't it?
It was. And it was fitting that we should recognise it by going to his university. Interestingly, if you look at Barry's life, his political trajectory, his interests, how on earth would you think of putting a director of GCHQ next to him? Well, because Barry was a practical person who understood why the country had things like intelligence services. Ian, our former director, was somebody who was firmly convinced that we needed to be more open, where it was possible for us to be more open about what we did. And the two of them got on. There was nothing really there to be surprised about, other than this was the first time that we'd ever tried to do anything like this. And Ian decided that perhaps my role as historian was one that GCHQ could use to do a bit more pushing in that general area. So when in 2014, we celebrated 100 continuous years of our station at Scarborough as SIGIN collection site, we decided that I would do a talk there in public. Now, something had happened in between, and that was Snowden and some of the documents he stole getting into the public domain. And we thought this will be interesting to see what happens. Will we have an audience full of people who are throwing bottles at me or what have you, or not? And it's where we discovered perhaps the level of the impact of the Snowden documents, that for most people, this was something that they'd read about, they'd thought about, and had nevertheless concluded that the UK still needed its intelligence services. And so we've done a lot of thinking then. Because one of the things that had come up in the same sort of time frame was that the development of technology, the development of the internet, the development of the way people use communications meant that GCHQ needed new legislation. The legislation that was in place before was covering us, but we were having to push increasingly at the sides of it to make what we needed to do fit inside a legislative framework. One of the things about the new legislation that we were advised in advance would have to happen was that we'd have to be far more explicit about what we do and how we do it than we ever have been hitherto. you look at the explanatory notes around the Investigatory Powers Act, it says quite specifically that, you know, GCHQ, in certain circumstances, when properly authorized, is allowed to interfere with the computers of people who've been designated as people who that this needs to happen to. It suddenly makes the old neither confirm nor deny absolutely impossible to maintain. So what we've had to do is take a step back and say, in the context of the new legislation, what can we talk about in terms of what we've done in the past, and what can't we talk about? What necessarily remains secret, given that we're a secret intelligence organization? And so there's been a lot of thinking, and it's brought us into this very new place where not only are you now allowed to use my name, but we're prepared to welcome the podcast physically into GCHQ spaces.
I mean, I'm sitting here now with a recording device in one of the most secret places in Britain, if not the world. I mean, that would never have happened 10 years ago, would it?
It would never have happened 10 years ago. And I'm not going to pretend that it was simply a case of filling in a form and saying, oh, Mark's going to bring his recorder with him. There's a lot more happened to make sure that you can do your recording, that we can be confident that you're not going to leave the place littered with sort of hidden devices and things like this, and that you're only going to be able to record things that we are confident are usable by you outside, that aren't going to compromise anything that we care about.
You talk about different levels of stuff being released and different amounts of information being released. For our veterans, for example, I mean, they were told that they could speak about their war work, and literally it's up to their end of the war, isn't it? Because some of them did go on to work in Eastcote when GCHQ was formed. So obviously they have a cut-off, but with the official release of documents, there's cut-offs there as well, isn't there? So obviously it must be a constant struggle to know how much can be released.
That's part of my job. Mm. And what we've done since the release of the wartime information, we've released all of the intelligence reporting on the Soviet and the non-Soviet Eastern European countries between 1945 and 1950. And the point of doing that was partly because the sensitivity of the information they contain has gone away. Mm. The current Russian government knows exactly what military forces it had in East Germany in 1947 and knows that we knew. You know, there aren't secrets there to protect anymore, so it's right that the information should be released to the public. And what we wanted to do was sort of to gauge who's interested in this. And what we've found is that whereas there's a lot of interest in Bletchley almost as a sociological thing, how did that group of people come together in the Second World War to do the incredible things that they actually did, and then look at the way that they all dissipated and went away after VJ Day?
I think you're right there. There's a certain amount of it that's not just the James Bondy spying bit. It's the actual the social history of that place, because it was a broad spectrum of society, from East End girls working teleprinters to debutantes. But they then all went out, as you say, into the world. We like to say on the podcast that we actually think of our veterans as still serving up till today, to be honest, because they kept that secret for 30 years. I mean, we still have veterans now who still won't talk about it. Some because they signed the Official Secrets Act, and even though they've had a letter from the government saying you can talk about it, they still won't. I interviewed a lady last year who won't speak about it because she swore on the Bible. And because she's very religious, she's not going to talk about it.
She gave her word.
Yeah. And they will go to the grave with that.
I mean, I'll say something there that's as true today as it was then. And again, it's something people don't often think about, but we reflect the society that we serve, we reflect the society that we're here to defend. So at a time of great national crisis, like the Second World War, you're drawing in people from all walks of life. You know, the government said that Bletchley could have, to a large extent, its pick of the available talent. Something similar today. You know, we have got the ability to recruit from across the UK. We have to temper what we do. We're opening centres in the north of England because there's a whole pool of talent in the big cities in the north of England that we need to attract into the organisation. but that aren't as taken by leafy, suburban, middle-class Cheltenham as perhaps people of an older generation. It's up to us to go to where we can get people to come in. But the important thing isn't to say if they're not prepared to come to us, well, we don't want them. It's to say we've got to fish in the biggest pool that we can to get the most talented people, because the work that's being done today is as vital for the security of the United Kingdom today as was the work being done at Bletchley between 1939 and 1945.
And GCHQ now, I've been talking about that, they're championing disabled employees a lot, aren't they, recently?
We've had a better than average record on diversity, I think, since the time of the First World War. If you look, you'll see that the people who worked in signals intelligence, First World War and between the wars, are different. You know, you'll see people who were from Ireland, from the Ascendancy, who, in their view, their country had disappeared after the First World War. You can see in an Alan Turing, somebody who was a child of empire, who barely saw his parents when he was growing up because they were in India and he was at school in the UK. We've always known how to really use diversity of talent and not straitjacket the people who bring particular gifts. And I think Deniston was the real prime example of creating that sort of environment. Today, you look at, say, disabled people, people who are physically disabled. We look at people who are neurally different and say, not do you fit a stereotype when you come, but what talents do you bring and are those talents that we can use?
Yeah.
And we will often, I mean, again, a saying that you'll often hear around here is great minds don't think alike.
Right.
You know, the point of great minds is that the people who think differently, you'll do far better with three people who think very differently about a problem in the same room than you will than three people who all think the same. Just the way in which different people will approach a problem from a slightly different angle is the thing that creates the spaces where you're going to have different talents bring together.
I think it's always been that way, hasn't it? The prime example would be the bomb during World War II. You know, Turing's idea for that. Because basically you're looking for what it couldn't be, aren't you? And then at the same time, you've got Welshman who says, oh, I've got this little idea and I could actually speed this up. Comes up with a diagonal board and all of a sudden we can read Enigma.
All of a sudden we've got a real solution and an electromechanical solution to an electromechanical problem.
Mm.
Skip forward 3 years from that and then look at Colossus and look at these great theoretical minds like Max Newman, like Alan Turing, and how they are having to come to say, how do we apply these brilliant thoughts that we've got? And at the other end of the scale there, you've got Tommy Flowers, who is this incredibly capable, imaginative engineer, but who, if you like, is given the license just to think in an unconstrained manner. How might you apply all of your knowledge about the use of valve technology into creating this machine? And I think that coming together of theoretical thinkers who got to think of a practical application for their beautiful thoughts, that meeting with somebody who is an incredibly capable practitioner, but who's had to work up to that point within the constraints of what the post office was allowing to happen in exchanges with switching machinery, that's something that we have to keep recreating all the time. How do you stop constrained thinking? How do you have unconstrained thinking? And how do you bring together people who would normally be completely separate and bring them together to all attack the same problem?
I think
together?
That must just be the ethos of GCHQ even these days, mustn't it?
I mean, people talk about agile as a philosophy of how a technological organization should approach problems. We're not going to be successful unless, at worst, we're abreast with the latest technologies. You know, at best, we need to be ahead. That's why in 1926, Travis went to Berlin to buy an Enigma machine. Nobody had any concept that intelligence targets might one day be using Enigma machines. But this was the latest technology. This was the new app of 1926. Yeah. So you need to know about it because you can't wait until the bad guys start using a new technology before you decide, oh, well, now's the time I'll start looking at it. You know, today that means scores of people looking at the new apps that are coming out for smartphones, just in case any of those is ever used. You know, 1926, it meant this new electromechanical device. Give that to Hugh Foss. Ironically, give it to the most junior cryptanalyst there is, Jungen. Yeah. Tell us what this is about. And then waiting 10 years, you know, until the Enigmas turned up in Spain that Hitler sent to General Franco. There was no amount of Enigma traffic audible in the UK that anybody could work on. Right. You know, you had to wait until the opportunity arose. But it's just indicative of the way we've always had to work.
1919 was when GCNCS was set up. So obviously next year you'll be celebrating your centenary, and that's why we're doing the show this month. So what have we got in store from GCHQ?
We've got two flagship projects that are already well underway. The first is an authorised history that's being written by Professor John Ferris. He's Professor of History at the University of Calgary, but he's spent the last 30 years becoming the foremost expert on the history of British signals intelligence. So he was an obvious person for us to ask to write the book, and not just because of his knowledge about the subject, but also because he understands what we sometimes talk about as the so what. It's all very well producing intelligence. Lots of people are quite interested in the details of what difference did it make to put the fourth rotor in the naval Enigma and things like this. But the big so what is, what difference does the intelligence that you produce make? And that's what John will cover in the authorised history.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we try to do with the episodes we do with Dave in our historian, where we pick a subject and we say, right, what did Bletchley have to do with this? And as you say, so what? Yeah. What did that lead to? Well, it led to this victory, or it led to this deception.
And that's really important, because I think too many people have gone away in the past with this idea that this little bubble called Bletchley Park suddenly appeared in 1939 and all these really clever people came in and did all these really clever things. And they forget that, so what? So the second big thing is that we're working with the Science Museum in London. And in 2019, to the end of the year, we will be a major exhibition at the Science Museum, which will explore, it'll go a bit beyond GCHQ, it'll go a bit beyond our 100 years to look more broadly at issues surrounding secrecy. But we'll be putting on display there for the first time quite a few things of the post-Second World War era, and just give people the first idea about what it's like to do the sort of work that we do, to really explore the technology of SIGINT over the past 100 years, and also to look forward and say, in the cyber era, what contribution is GCHQ making today to cybersecurity, and how can we help not just the government, but our fellow citizens make themselves more secure in an increasingly joined up world?
So I think that's the biggest problem we're facing, is the lack of people's worry about cybersecurity, I think, because our lives are so dominated now by these things we have in our pockets, which, you know, if you went back to Turing or Welshman, couldn't have conceived of the power that they have. I mean, possibly Turing could have. So that gives us amazing power, but it also gives an amazing level of threat, doesn't it?
Exactly. Imagine that today the government wants to do whatever it can of its business with the citizen through the internet. So, for example, you don't have to go to a passport office to renew your passport. You can do it online. What are the levels of trust that you need for you to be confident that you can put all of this information onto a website and that it will be protected? And what level of trust does the government need to know that it is Mark Cotton who's applying to renew his passport, and not someone who just happens to find out, theoretically, that you might have just let yours lapse and not have a current one anymore. So they're trying to steal your identity to do something. It sounds quite trivial. It's the sort of thing in the past that you'd have got the vicar who lived down the road to sign a thing that said that you really were who you said you were, and the lady in the post office to say, yeah, you filled out the forms properly. We've got a different sort of model for how security works nowadays, and it's our job to make sure that that's going to work properly.
it's a real honour to be where I am now. I'm literally in the heart of GCHQ, right in the middle of the building. Anyone who's seen the building will know it's called the donut because it's donut shaped. And I'm looking through the window at the courtyard at the moment. And that courtyard is so big, Tony, isn't it? What could fit in there?
We could put the Albert Hall in there and still be able to walk around the outside of it along the footpath that we've got.
Now, the reason you brought me here is because this is your museum, isn't it?
It is. And what we've got is something that enables us to tell our story in our way. We're very lucky that Bletchley Park tells the story of signals intelligence during the Second World War. We're very glad that we've been able to loan lots of artefacts that you can use there to tell part of our story. But it frees this up to allow us to tell stories at any level, from completely unclassified right through to top secret, because you're actually inside the building.
And some of the stuff here you've got is remarkable. And it goes from pre-First World War. I mean, you just showed me something from 1907. But we've got stuff literally more or less up to now, haven't we?
Yeah.
And then everything in between.
And the 1907 stuff is from Simla, from sort of HQ India. And it's where the first British script analysis took place in the modern era before the First World War. But sort of non-Bletchley things that we've got examples of some of the intelligence reporting on the Soviet target that we've been releasing to the National Archives. Over here, we've got the Noreen encryption device that was used on the Royal Yacht Britannia.
And it just looks like a 1950s typewriter with a teleprinter.
Well, it's a 1950s encryption device that would attach, if necessary, to a teleprinter. I mean, functional is something that we're quite good at. And we get right through to the modern era in a description of some of the secure speech systems, ranging from Pickwick, which was the first national secure speech system of the transistor era. You can see a circuit board with transistors on, which appeals to the inner geek in lots of GCHQ people.
And this
people.
Is a bright red Bakelite telephone, like 1950s telephone. It looks like you would expect the hotline to look.
And you notice it's got no dial on to make sure that the calls can only take place if professional people have put the right crypto online so that people can talk securely. But we've got this telephone called Brent, which you'll still see in ministries in Whitehall. This was the first secure telephone of the digital era, sat on ISDN lines, still perfectly secure, but we continually develop new systems. And eventually you can see a small phone there that you might want to describe to the people listening to the podcast.
Looks like a probably late 1990s Nokia style handset, really, isn't it?
It's exactly that. It's a 1990s GSM mobile phone, with the difference that on the back of it there's a bulgy thing that isn't an extra battery. It's a secure unit. That's the first secure digital mobile phone.
No Twitter on there?
Absolutely no Twitter on there, nor any other apps either. And one of the problems is that if you saw anybody using a phone that was nearly 20 years old nowadays, you'd stand out like a sore thumb. It would be a real giveaway. That's why that phone's in a museum. We've moved on to much more modern, secure phones.
And one of the other things here, on the walls, you've actually got plaques. Is that members who've died within service?
We've got people who died in service. They're also commemorated inside the courtyard alongside some military colleagues who died in service in the period since the Second World War. But we also commemorate people who are alive. Every year, our director does awards, which are an in-house award, either for distinguished service over a number of years or for outstanding achievement. And they're commemorated internally. It's not a commemoration that happens outside. No. But that's a message, if you like, from the director to all staff. These are the people against whom you have to measure yourself. These are the people who really have achieved something.
I think what's remarkable about this place is, yes, there's lots of levels of security to get in here. I've had to go through a number of levels. But it's not oppressive, is it? It's just like a modern office block.
It is.
though I'd like to think that we do rather more interesting things in here than in most modern office blocks, the thing you have to remember is that everything's at the human scale. You can talk about GCHQ as the National SIGINT organisation, or you can talk about GCHQ as this big headquarters building in Cheltenham. Actually, GCHQ is all of the people who work here and all of the people on whose shoulders we're standing. GCHQ is an organisation of individuals. It's not this big corporate thing.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.